But she graciously agreed to share with you this evening her experience as an academic librarian in Canada and some of the trends she sees emerging across Canada in academic libraries and elsewhere. Sophie is a, her official title is a business librarian. Is that the official title?
Yes.
Business librarian at the Bronfman Business Library at York University. And there she provides reference and research assistance to business students and faculty. She also gives information literacy sessions, and she looks after collections in specific business areas. While she's been here, she's been conducting a survey study on continuing professional development in Ireland for the school. It's been quite helpful, the data she's collected for us on that topic. So tonight, the title of her talk is Reflections on New and Emerging Service Directions in Canadian Academic Libraries. And with that, I'd like us to welcome Sophie and thank her for coming.
Thank you for that very nice introduction, Diane. And with that, you have a pretty good idea of who I am and why I'm here. Thank you for describing that so nicely. And I'm really pleased to see there's a mix of people here tonight. I think, well, you know, we have some people from SILS, some of our postgraduate students, faculty, and we also have, I think, some former students from the school here, maybe from the UCC Library, I think. So great to have a mix of people here, and I'm grateful to you all for coming. I must say, when Diane asked if I would do this talk, I was very interested, and I started working on this talk and realized it's pretty massive, this topic. So I think being for my abstract, I've needed to be selective. But it also was useful because it helped me stand back and reflect about what is happening in Canadian academic libraries, and that exercise was very useful. Basically, what I'm going to do, as I said, is I'll talk about selective services. But before I sort of give you an outline of what I'm going to cover, I just actually one kind of more item of business in a way. I wanted to record this session, and it is recording right now, which I feel is okay because it's just recording. I think Diane was okay with it, and I'm okay with it, but when we get to the Q&A session, if anyone in this room is not okay with it being recorded, let me know. I'll check in with you when we get to that point as well. But if anyone has issues, just let me know, and that can be cut out. But it's just so that others can benefit from it on the web. And if you look at what I've given you on your reading list, this is just some of the things I'll be referring to through my presentation. You'll see at the bottom of the second page, I've put my web address, and I will upload the slides and the audio there. So if there are any of your colleagues, maybe, or people you know of who you think might like it, feel free, obviously, to share it. And what I used in putting this presentation together was a number of things. I certainly did draw on what I've learned from the rollout of new services at York University Library, but I also read quite a lot in putting this together. And when we roll out services at York, generally, we don't always do this, but generally I think we have a fairly strong culture of doing research on what has been done already, what we can learn from the literature. So we look at examples of academic libraries elsewhere and best practices and that kind of thing. So one article that I sort of thought about when I was putting this together, I don't know if any of you know it, it's by Jerry Campbell, who is the Dean of Libraries at University of, let me get this right, the University of Southern California in LA. And it's a very inspiring article called Changing a Cultural Icon, the Academic Library is a Virtual Destination. And he says, because of the fundamental role that academic libraries have played in the past century, it's tremendously difficult to imagine a library without one. But on the other hand, considering the pace at which knowledge is moving to the web, it's difficult to really know what an academic library will be and do in another decade. And he has some very interesting thoughts about how academic libraries need to change their mission to remain relevant. And I'd really recommend that article. I think one of the things I took from that article is that we can't be complacent and that we have to reinvent ourselves continuously to stay relevant. And another, I don't know if any of you follow what David Lank does, but one of my colleagues on Twitter recently, I guess he had been to the Charleston conference, and he had talked about this talk by David Lank. And again, that's on your reading list. Just suggested useful additional stuff if you want to look at it. David Lank did a talk there on new librarianship, and he is quite motivational if you want to listen to it on the web. He said the best days of librarianship are ahead of us, but he said we have to remember that success in current tasks does not mean future success. And he said, it's not enough to ride the wave. You've got to keep away from machines. And I think it's a very inspirational talk. And I am not going to pretend for a second that I could begin to emulate what Jerry Campbell or David Light do and think. And David Light, by the way, is an associate professor at the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. And all I'm saying is that I think whenever we are thinking about our services or when we want to plan new services, connecting with people like that and what they have to say is important. So I did a little bit of that type of reading when I was preparing this talk. Now, given the scope of the talk, I just knew quite quickly that I hadn't the knowledge to put it together myself. I mean, as Diane mentioned, I'm a business librarian. I'm also very interested in information literacy, and I have chaired our information literacy committee. But I'm not an expert in everything, obviously. So I spent actually quite a lot of time emailing my colleagues and Skyping in a few cases with them to talk to them about digital initiatives, information literacy, reference services and learning spaces, because I knew I could learn a lot from them. These are the people I would like to thank who helped me. And also one non-York person, which is Madeline Lefebvre at Ryerson. I don't know if you've heard of Ryerson, it's in Toronto. And they are doing very interesting things with learning spaces, and I did talk to her on the phone, so I'd like to thank her as well. And I have sort of, this is going to be sort of the agenda, and I have structured this so that there should be a good 10 or 15 minutes for conversation at the end. So I, obviously will welcome that. And, if anything goes unclear as I go along, feel free also to just chime in or say something, that's fine. I'm going to talk about learning spaces first of all, learning spaces advances. Then I'm going to talk about what academic libraries are doing to support the research agenda in higher education. Now that's a massive topic. Again, I've been selective. I'm going to talk about information literacy and new trends in reference services. Again, with all of them, I've had to be selective. But I hope you'll find it interesting. So learning spaces is an area I find fascinating, actually. I've been a bit involved in my own institution with this, but I wouldn't call myself an expert, though I know more than I used to now, and I want to thank Mark Robertson, our associate university librarian, who knows a lot about this area and talked to me. I think one of the biggest things we're seeing happen is, I've been talking to Irish librarians here, and just knowing what I know about the UK, I think it's happening here too, that there is a shifting philosophy from an information commons model to a learning commons model. So what's the difference? And I think Beagle is quite interesting on this. What he says to us about information commons is that with an information commons, there's a lot of emphasis on the tools and the technology, which is made available to support learning. And there's a lot of emphasis in a information commons model between on computers and software and lots of technology, and bringing together your reference people and your IT specialists. That's typically what an information commons is about. The learning commons, and that's Ryerson, by the way. Now, I'm not saying that's what they do, but that's an element of what they do. So what he said is it becomes a learning commons when you combine the resources of the information commons with learning initiatives sponsored by other academic units. And often there is a goal of aligning learning outcomes defined through a cooperative process. So who are these academic units? Typically in a learning commons, I'm sure some of you are familiar with this, you would have the library collaborating with the writing centre people, with the learning skills support people, and also then sometimes with career services, with academic advising, with peer learning and support type services. And again, it can go beyond that. Those are some examples. So I think a big reason why this is such an important focus is because it breaks down silos. In universities, up till now, before the learning commons, you had your writing centre in one place, your library in one place, your academic like learning skills in another place, and they weren't talking to each other a lot. And yet, when you think about students doing research, it's an iterative, recursive process. So they don't do their research and then do their writing. It all needs to feed into each other. So I think, you know, we're starting to see how those silos are breaking down, and that is for the benefit of how that is for the benefit of learning. And this is, again, Ryerson. So you can see they've got a commons learning lab, and they also have their learning support people based there. They have writing professionals based there too. So they are moving towards a learning commons model. Now, and this is Guelph, which does a great job. Now, people sometimes laugh when I say the word Guelph. I guess it sounds a bit funny. It's a place in Ontario, very nice place, actually, near Toronto. And they have a university which has had a learning commons in place for a while now. And I'll come back to them soon. But in terms of what's driving this change, and why academic libraries are moving towards learning commons models, I think in North American context, I don't know if you've heard of NESE, the National Survey of Student Engagement, and a lot of North American universities are taking part, and it's to kind of measure students' engagement in terms of their activities in the classroom, outside the classroom, and learning is a part of that. And then we have emphasis on new types of pedagogies like inquiry-based learning, problem-based learning, etc. And I think that is also making for a change because information literacy, for example, which is often the learning, where learning comes into play in libraries, is often connected with those approaches. For example, at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, or at McMaster, where they have a very good medicine program, that's in Ontario, they've had information literacy intertwined in the medical and health curricula because it works well with inquiry-based learning. And then also this emphasis on fostering independent lifelong learning, which I'm sure you're seeing in your mission statements here for your universities. And often, the ability to find, use, and evaluate information being recognised as one of those, you know, a skill that an independent learner would have. So I've talked about how in the learning commons it's important to have collaboration between different academic units, but another really important element is how do you design your space to foster learning, the type of learning that you want. And this is something written by our associate university librarian, Mark Robertson, who's written this 21st Century Learning Space document. It's a model for the Scott Library, which is our social sciences and humanities library. what are some of the thoughts out there in the literature? And Mark's done a huge amount of work on that. One of the things is that you should have learning which is of a social and communal nature. You should also try to have synergy between learning and social functions. So here is University of British Columbia, their Learning Commons, and you can see that you've got differentiated space, but also you have two very different types of areas adjacent to each other. So you have somebody reading, obviously wanting to be comfortable and informal, and the computer's here behind her, where they're doing other kinds of tasks. So there's a lot of that in learning commons. I think another common desired characteristic of a learning commons is that you have an attractive space with a lot of natural light. I think Mills Learning Commons at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, have done a good job of that. The other thing is that it should be a place where you can work individually but also work in groups. And here is Carleton's Learning Commons there in Ottawa. An additional characteristic of a learning commons is flexible, customizable space. And here you can see Ryerson's fourth floor space, and they've done a lot of interesting stuff there. And the students have the ability to move things around and to adjust their environment depending on what they want to do. And they love it, apparently. It's always packed. I know it doesn't look like that here, but apparently it is during term time. The other thing that people I spoke to said is that if you look at the literature on the learning commons, there's a lot of emphasis on third place. The library is third place, which apparently refers to a place outside of formal disciplinary structures. So outside of formal classroom environments where learning can take place. And the university librarian at Ryerson said to me that they had a book, set to showcase the publications of their faculty here and how well that went, because it showcased the library not just as somewhere that stores knowledge or stores information, but somewhere that it was a place where information and knowledge could be showcased and promoted, and also sort of show the library's role in cultural and civic activities. So the library as town hall concept there. Now, I don't, obviously, and you wouldn't want to listen to me, have time to talk about all the learning commons in Canada. Just a few quick examples, though, I think, of three universities with learning commons, where I think they've done certain things well. Now, okay, maybe I'm biased here, this is my university. But I think our associate university librarian did a very good job. We're planning the learning commons. And he was very, very conscious of the importance of user-centered discovery. And I don't know if you're familiar with what Georgia Tech has done. On the list I've given you, you'll see there's an item by Chris Stewart. And he's from Georgia Tech. I think he now works with ARL. And there's a space planning pre-programming kit. So if any of you are designing learning spaces or interested in learning spaces, you could look at that, and that's what we did. Lots of ways that you can get feedback from the students about what they want and not make the mistake of presuming you know what the students want. And I was involved in the affinity focus groups, and it was a really great, fun process, and we learned a lot. I'm not going to talk about the methodology of each of those, but I just wanted to bring your attention to them and have a look at Chris Stewart's publication if you're interested. But here's just a snapshot of kind of what we learned. One of the things in the affinity focus groups was we said to the students, okay, tell us what you want this space to look like. Tell us what you want to do in this space. And they threw out lots of very concrete ideas, like I want bean bags, or I want an aquarium. They had lots of, I want art to be exhibited that is done by the students. and then they had more kind of what you might expect sort of ideas things like I want individual study panels or I want computers, but it was all over the map and we encouraged them to be creative. And I thought what was really inspiring was when they had to group their ideas into categories and find a metaphor to describe each of those groupings. And interestingly, even though we did about 6 different affinity focus groups, they fell into these categories quite quickly and easily. So aesthetics, comfort, flexible differentiated space, technology-rich environment where you have services and you are guaranteed that you're going to have a healthy, secure environment. So we kind of learned that the things we thought were important, but they also alerted us to new ideas and new ways of going about doing things. But I think some of these are quite nice, these metaphors, and they just say a lot, just all by themselves. Okay, Ryerson has been very interesting in terms of the out-of-the-box approach it's had when it's been working on this new student learning center. Basically, they have a $45 million grant at Ryerson to build this student learning center, and the library is a big component. So that the librarian there said to me they're trying to infuse the concept of the learning commons throughout the whole building. So it's not just one level in the building. And Madeline Lefebvre, who is the university librarian, just to give you an idea, I thought that was one of the most creative examples of planning that I came across, because they're not just looking at other libraries for ideas of how to design their space. They're looking at the retail world. They're looking at, this is an example of the Nintendo World Store, apparently in New York City. They're also looking at, she said this is an example of something they liked because of the gaming element. Maybe, you know, there's talk about whether you could use gaming in libraries to as a way to teach students information skills, for example. And then also the fact that you have this exercise equipment. So there's a lot of stuff out there about how millennials like multitasking. So not that they're going to put a game with a pod in their library, but it's just kind of, it's helping them think about things. And then she said airport lounges are also inspirational to them because of what they've done around relaxation zones or comfort zones. And here's a napping pod, which I think they have at some airports, I've heard. Now, whether you're going to support student napping through armchairs or through napping pods or through nothing, I guess that's up to the library. But again, I guess if they're thinking about it. And certainly we heard from our students they'd like to be able to take the odd nap in the library. And then these are the libraries they've looked at at Ryerson. And you can see Georgia Tech there. It's an amazing space. Not that I've been there, but I've seen a lot of photos. And Chris Stewart came to talk to us. And it's an amazing, flexible, diverse space. And the students, again, apparently it's packed. And Winnipeg Centennial Library is a public library. And Madeline sort of said to me, you know, academic libraries shouldn't make the mistake of forgetting about public libraries and what they can learn from public libraries. And she, in her opinion, you know, they're coming closer, especially in terms of how they're designing space. And this is the Saltier Centre. Now, I must admit, I don't know a huge amount about it, but what Madeline said to me is that it was a very controversial space when it was designed. And she said that was good and bad, because some things really didn't work, apparently, but some things were a great success. I guess blended learning being one example. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Saltier Centre in Glasgow. I think affiliation Glasgow Caledonia University. But she said they're looking at that because it's making them think about possible approaches. And I'm just going to mention Guelph again. I said I'd come back to Guelph University. I think, and this is one point that Mark, our associate university librarian, made to me. He said there is an awful lot of focus on how we should design the space and what furniture should we have, what equipment should we have, and on sort of that kind of focus. And he said, what Guelph has done really well is not so much designing their space, but thinking beyond the physical space dimensions to establish a very solid theoretical foundation for their learning commons. So they've done a really, really good job in collaboration with other units, academic units. And if you read this article by Schmidt and Kaufman, who are two of the people very involved in Guelph, you'll learn about how they fought their collaboration out. You'll also learn that they haven't just said, well, yes, we want to have student-centered pedagogy and we want to support that. They really, really fought that out and they've come up with educational models which they think can help them do this. I can't remember the details, but I know the article is very helpful. I also think what's useful is that they, and some of you I'm sure are familiar with this, they have three levels of services, which usually refers to the programming, the workshops, the classes that they are organizing. So they have supplemental services, integrated services, and embedded services. And I've heard some of the librarians I've met here talk about information literacy like that. So supplemental is where you're giving more like a generic skills type of workshop or class. Integrated is where you specially design your classes and your workshops for a particular audience, maybe mature students, or you design them for a particular program or a particular course. And embedded is where you go that step further and integrate the class, the instruction into the curriculum. So that's really kind of your ultimate goal. And they've really thought that out. And what does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? And how do we achieve it? And this was Nancy Schmidt's advice to us. You've got to think about all of those four elements that are designing the learning commons. And also peer learning, that's the fourth principle they have, support peer learning. And they talk about how they do that. They have a very successful peer learning support program. So students helping students. It works well. Now, I'm going to move on to talk about how academic libraries in Canada have been trying to support the research agenda. There is a big push in Canada, and I certainly have seen it here as well, that universities want to foster an enhanced faculty research culture. They want to see research rankings improve. They want to promote what their faculty are doing and their postgraduate students in terms of research. And so how do libraries come into that? I'm going to talk about that, and I also just want to mention that this objective is also very common in our universities in Canada. I don't know if it is here, enhancing graduate education, it is. So that, I think that really ties in as well. When we say graduate education, we mean postgraduate education. The terminology here is a little different. But basically, that obviously has connections with research, right? So I could have talked about a lot of different things here. I think when you talk to faculty about, well, how does the academic library support the research agenda, a lot of faculty would say, well, it supports it through collections. I see their point, but I'm actually not really talking about collections. I'm more talking about services here. And I could have talked about things beyond this, but these are the three that I did choose. Now, I know I mentioned in my abstract virtual research environments, and I just thought that was important to put in there because I think that is something that sometimes academic libraries are involved in. It's not my area of expertise, though. I know Diane is an area of expertise for her, and others, I think Judith Wussman here, still also. I just wanted to mention the context of VRE because I know at University of Prince Edward Island, they've won at least one award for their virtual research environment, and they, Mark Leggett is the university librarian there. So if any of you are interested, I certainly do have some useful reading on that. But these are the three areas I'm going to focus on. So when I talked to Our digital initiatives librarian, Andrea Kofovich, I put some of her publications on their list. And she was sort of giving me, I mean, I do know a certain amount about this area, but she spent at least an hour on the phone with me, or on Skype with me, just for this phone, I guess, telling me about this in a Canadian context. And I said to Andrea, well, what would you stress to Canadian people if you don't have much time? And she said, I would definitely mention synergies. Because this is something where Canada has been a pioneer, and it is a very interesting project. Basically, the reason why synergies evolved was because social sciences and humanities literature was what is largely print-based, and there was a concern to move that online. And so the Synergy project emerged. One thing that's interesting about it, it emerged in the late 1990s, which is pretty early. It's basically the services and infrastructure that was needed to move this SSH, Social Sciences and Humanities content, online. There was a $14 million grant from the Canadian Foundation for Innovation to make this possible. And another thing I think that's quite unique about Synergy is that 21 Canadian universities were involved, 5 regional nodes, so you have a very high level of collaboration and a consortial element. Now, the other thing is that Andrea said to stress the technological advances that have come with this. So she said in Canada, you know, she said Europe is absolutely amazing when it comes to institutional repositories and digitization. She said, like, they win hands down compared to Canada. But she said, we actually have done a really good job when it comes to open journal systems, and we've made advances because of this substantial funding which had to go towards technical infrastructure. So you will see the open journal systems at ROD, which is a Quebecois-based system for hosting journals. And apparently what they've done there is very impressive. And also then you have GSpace, which is used typically for hosting institutional repositories in Canada, and then the Open Conference system. And at the moment, all of these universities are populating the system with the content, mainly journals, and also theses. Apparently U of T, University of Toronto, have done a lot of stuff with theses, and it's been pretty successful. They're also building this portal infrastructure so that someone will be able to come in and search synergies and interact with these platforms in a pretty seamless way. So it's in beta stage and it will be launched hopefully in 2010. So Andrea explained to me that when you look at institutional repositories in Canada, it's very important to remember that synergies has driven this in a lot of cases. And that a lot of Canadian institutional repositories are beyond the planning stages. If they are in the stage of implementation, I'm not saying they're there yet, but they have got the planning stage, beyond the planning stages very often. There are 33 higher education institutions in Canada with institutional repositories. So institutional repositories are a digital collection of an institution's intellectual output. And obviously not all of that institution's intellectual output, but that's what they aim to do, is to be somewhere where academics can put their research, and they will then have the benefit of it being disseminated more broadly, of it being cited more widely. That's another thing that institutional repositories can do. They can increase use and visibility of scholars' research. And very often, if not always, I'm not sure if always, but they open access materials, so they're freely available. So there's an obvious link with the research agenda, and libraries have been often. I mean, CARL, which is the Canadian Association of Research Libraries, if you look at their website, 80% of its members have got an institutional repository. So you can see that academic libraries are key players there. So this is something that is related scholarly communications, and I think scholarly communications is a very unfortunate term. And I know there was a talk at DIT Libraries maybe a week ago or so about scholarly communications and open access, or maybe it's next week. Anyway, I know I can't go and I'm disappointed. But so obviously it's the same here for academic libraries. But first of all, what on earth is scholarly communication? Because it is a very amorphous term. When it's talked about in the context of academic libraries, what we usually are talking about is open access, raising awareness of open access. We're also talking about supporting scholars' options for publication, letting them know what those options are. We're talking about author rights, making scholar academics know what their rights are as authors. We're talking about copyright issues, and we'd also be talking about bibliometrics, I think, ties in there, and making, helping or being a player on campus in terms of how research indicators work, citation metrics work, what's the upside, what's the downside of those metrics in terms of the ones that especially that are given a lot of kudos, like the ISI indicators. That's something a scholarly communications initiative at a library is often doing. And at our library, and I hate to harp on about York, but we actually are one of the first libraries to develop a scholarly communications committee. Ours was established in 2007. At least in Ontario, we have been. And apparently the website and the initiatives have been referenced in the literature and at conferences and things like that. So, but we know a lot of other libraries are doing this. Our group did a review of recent jobs, job postings and advertisements, and at least 7 of them had scholarly communications as an element. So they're hiring scholarly communications librarians, or they're making it an element in their job, or we're finding that libraries are creating scholarly communications committees. And this is our, and you're welcome to go there, scholcom.yorku.ca, to see what our group has done. And here are some of their initiatives. So if any of you are interested in setting up a group like that, I'd be glad to put you in touch with our co-chairs of that committee. But basically, one of the things they did was they attended the AFRL Scholarly Communication Institute, because that helped them learn how you would roll out a scholarly communications program for your library. They established a website. They also did a retreat for the librarians to educate them on these issues. They had a speaker series, and I don't know if you've heard of Jean-Paul Guidon and Leslie Chan, but they're two open access scholars in Canada, and they're quite well known. So they came in and talked, and that drew a lot of faculty. We also had our librarians in October of this year adopt an open access publishing policy, and I think in the States, I know Stanford and MIT and Harvard have done that at the faculty level, I believe. At least some form of open access publishing has been embraced. So, the final thing is we had an event during Open Access Week where it was called Faculty and Librarian Deposit Day, and we encouraged the faculty and librarians to come in and put their research into our institutional repository. Now, has it worked? These are some of the things Andrea said she would share if she was talking to someone interested in scholarly communications, particularly, in an academic library. Yes, going to the Scholarly Communication Institute was a good idea. They learned from experts right from the beginning. Yes, having a retreat for the librarians was a good idea because you've got to start close to home. And one thing Andrea said they've learned is that scholarly communications issues really need to be framed in the context of a discipline. So it's not really good to go to a huge faculty event and do an open access or a SCOLCOM spiel, because that's not going to go down well. It's too out of context. And so she said it's important to get your subject librarians involved, having those conversations. And she also said that you need to speak the language of the target audience and meet them at the point of need. I mentioned to you we had that day where we said to faculty, please come in and deposit your articles in your space. And nobody came. And Andrea said after they thought about it, well, that's not surprising. We're asking faculty to come in, deposit their research on our timetable. You know? So you got to do it at the point of need. And she said she had their most successful examples of doing things that have worked have been where, say, for example, a faculty member said, I want to publish a journal. I want to use Outland Journal Systems to do this. And then maybe then you can bring in the open access angle. Or they talk to you about copyright issues, and then you bring in the author rights discussion. But you've got to listen to what their needs are, their issues are, and start there. You've got to listen to concerns. It's got to be about dialogue. It's not about placing librarians as the experts on campus. It's about working together to do this. And she said those are the things they've learned in 2 years about the whole thing. And they are not going to do, they are going to do a much more tailored approach, go to individual schools, individual faculty, and talk to them about what they can do together to support scholarly communications at the institution. So I thought that was really interesting. I'll just talk, I'll just skim over this, but I just wanted to mention to you, I mean, and I'm happy to share more material with you, that in Canada, I think one of the differences in North America is that very often librarians are in the faculty association and they have faculty status. Now, certainly we do not have to produce anything like the number of publications that academic faculty have to, but we nonetheless are expected to, and at my institution we have a 6-year review process, so it goes on for quite a while. And you get sabbaticals very often. So that's what I'm doing now, and all my colleagues are entitled to that every 6 years. So we've had to think about librarians' research and how we can promote librarians' research as part of promoting the research culture of the institution. And you'll be able to look at this when I put it up on the web, but one thing we have done is a 3-year plan of action with 4 cornerstones where we have identified ways in which we can enhance our librarians' research output. Because I'm sure anyone in this room who's a librarian appreciates that the way our jobs are structured is there are not spaces carved out for us to do research necessarily. It doesn't happen as automatically as it does for faculty. And so you've got to put some effort into creating those spaces. So that might be days off, but it might also be trying to create research clusters, which is sort of informal groups where we'll come together to talk about common research interests. And we're doing other things as well. And another thing is promoting awareness of what we're doing, because faculty, I think, tend to think of us as people who house knowledge but don't create it. And this is a website. If any of you are interested in this, it is at the moment on our staff website, but I'm sure I could get permission to share it with you. I think I could. Certainly email me if you're interested. And this is a website we have designed to support librarians who want to do research. Where do you get grants? You know, where can you find useful workshops on campus about research methodologies? So that is a sort of, I know this is a whirlwind tour, but I'm going to move on now to information literacy. As I said, this is an area I'm very interested in myself. And I think if you were to talk about emerging and new directions at academic libraries here, or I think in the UK or Ireland, you couldn't leave information literacy out, because it is a strategic priority. And I think there are a lot of things driving this, but I think here are a few of them. One is the mission statements and planning documents of universities, placing emphasis on lifelong learning and graduating independent thinkers. And this is an example of the University of Toronto of this saga, which had Cheryl Hook, who's pretty famous in information literacy circles. And they've done a great job of information literacy programming there. And their mandate said that the ability to seek information and the ability to find and use information is a lifelong learning skill. So it's identified right up front as an attribute of a graduate, a desired attribute. I mentioned before the shift towards student-centered teaching and learning, and then another thing when it comes to information literacy that I think is really critical, and I don't know if you're familiar with the US, they have accreditation standards. So in the US, like the Middle States Commission, states, you know, you've got to define your learning objectives and your learning outcomes, and you've got to give attention to certain elements. One of those elements is information literacy. And so in the States, they really had a mandate to pay attention and see if what they're doing is successful. But in Canada, not so much. But it's starting to change, and in Ontario, we have now the undergraduate degree level expectations, which means that at undergraduate level, at least, we have to frame learning objectives, and we have to pay attention to these guidelines. So every new program and every program that's being reviewed at the undergraduate level now has to think about those guidelines and how are they showing through learning objectives they're paying attention to the things I put up there. Information literacy is pretty obvious. Information literacy, I think, if you look at these, you can't deny it's an element here. And so I think that, and just sort of academic skills generally getting more recognition. So I think that's a big opportunity for us in Ontario. So I said it's a strategic priority for libraries. Here's some of the reasons why, or how we know. In Ontario, we've had about, in the region of 8,000 library presentations a year to students. Those are OCL statistics that I got. So a good volume of presentations being given. We've had more information literacy coordinator roles. We've had a lot of emphasis at conferences on information literacy, plus our own conference, the Willow Conference, which is now well regarded. We have very much embraced the ACRL standards. And learning common development are important. And in terms of LIS scholars, Heidi Julian has done a lot of work on information literacy across Canadian libraries, public and academic, and she's on your list. So you might want to look at what she said. I think where we're doing very badly is advocacy at a national level, and the States does a much better job. And basically, if you look at information literacy, there's a lot of elements, but these are three I think we give quite a lot of attention to. I'm sure you do here too. Curriculum integration, information literacy, e-learning and assessment. And in Canada, we very much look to ACRL and the standards, information literacy standards, that they've come up with, the five standards, when we're framing our programs. We also look at ACRL's characteristics of programs of information literacy, which illustrate best practice. And if you're familiar with that, it basically is very explicit about framing how you're going to integrate information literacy into the curriculum. And I don't want to give you the impression, though, that all the libraries in Canada have been successful in integrating information literacy everywhere, because it's not the case. There are lots of examples of them having success with a few programs. At our university, we have 7 programs where we've integrated information literacy. So often you have the curriculum integration happening in combination with the supplemental and integration approaches, which I mentioned earlier when I was talking about what Wealth does, right? So it's a work in progress, but I think basically a big motivator is the fact that we have to move beyond traditional library instruction, where we just focus on how do you find information, how do you use information, to how do you evaluate information, and also the social context of information. It's about critical engagement with information and the information-seeking process. And that's what Shapiro and Hughes, in this very famous article, talk about. And curriculum-integrated information literacy gives you a lot more time, right? And you need that time to talk about information literacy when it's defined like this. E-learning, definitely very much on the agenda. We have hired an e-learning librarian at York, and there are some other institutions who have done that. A lot of integration within VLEs, virtual learning environments like Blackboard and Moodle. If you're interested, I have an item on your list written by Sarah Coit and Barbara Jeffrey, which talk about two examples in Canada. And I know you've got examples here in Ireland. And just, you might be interested in these two. Sarah Coit, our e-learning librarian, said you might want to tell them about, it's called the e-learning for librarians and ideas playground. It's a wiki resource, and it's a place you can go to get e-learning tips and links to repositories of information literacy tutorials. But it's also where you can go to find e-learning case studies in Canada. And also, she said, ANTS has a very important Canadian contribution. It was actually originally a Canadian project. I don't know if you know it, but if you can get tutorials designed using screencasting software, and they're open, you can go in there and you can look at them. You can also avail of the source code in many cases, so you can tweak the tutorials yourself. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. That's pretty critical, obviously, you know, because they take a lot of time, these tutorials, and not having to reinvent the wheel is very useful. In the area of information literacy assessment, I think we've still got a lot of things that we need to do. Julian and Boone in 2002 were actually, I think, a little appalled by the state of information literacy assessment in Canada. That it's just informal and formative. We're not doing a lot to see whether students are learning. And they said, you know, there is a lot of room for progress. But I just want to draw your attention to things that have happened since then. We've had sales. We've had, I think, at least 7 libraries in Canada participating in sales. Has anyone heard of sales? Yeah? Yeah. So it's a standardized, valid, reliable testing tool, which is online, which relies on the ACRL objectives as the foundation, and which allows you to see how your students are doing at a point in time, allows you to benchmark. We participated in 2005, and it was useful, but it had its limits, obviously. It was multiple choice, and it's a cohort tool, so it only allows you to see how your group students are doing at a point in time. You can't tailor it to a specific course. And then this one, iSkills, apparently it's just become called iCritical Thinking, is something even better, people would argue, because it is an example of performance assessment. So students actually have to perform real tasks, like information literacy tasks, computer knowledge is applied, and University of Toronto and Mississauga took part in that. And then Wattsdale, an Augustana University project, I was very interested when I heard about this. This is the tool they designed to manage their assessment, so to create a database of questions, to roll the assessments out, and then to generate reports. They've now made this open source. So any library, you don't have to be Canadian, can use this. And I certainly want to start looking at this when I get back to my university, because I think it looks really promising. Okay, and I am very conscious it is now 6 o'clock, so I'm going to make sure I do not have more than 5 minutes to go through this, and we have 10 minutes for questions, so you can bear with me. I'm nearly there. One thing I just wanted to finish off with is reference services. Now, again, changes in reference services is a huge area onto itself. But in Canada, certainly we've seen a growth of that in electronic reference services, and these statistics speak to that. Why? I mean, I think, like anywhere else, we want to go out to the places the students are in. We know they're not going to come to the desk to talk to us. We've got to be in the places where they are, And as you can see, we're not relying on email anymore as our way of doing reference, but we are looking at synchronous methods as well. So chat and virtual reference services being very important. And in some cases, some libraries, there's even a multimedia element. Now, I think one thing you might be interested in is the AFCON initiative, which is a collaborative initiative. And this is something where you have real-time chat with students or with public library users, because you have public libraries in this project, and you also have academic libraries. You have 21 academic libraries. You might think, well, how on earth does that work? How is it funded? Well, government is one of the people who funds this. The Ontario Library Association is involved, and the Ontario Council of University Libraries. But all of the participating institutions contribute by staff in kind, by just giving staff who man the reference service. And basically, it has been pretty successful. This is the website. And just in terms of how it works a little bit, you accuse. So it doesn't mean that I participated in this service and giving the service. It doesn't mean I have to answer a question from a public library. And thank God, because I wouldn't be skilled enough, right? It's quite different. So that was never combined, the public library and the academic library service. They separate queues out. And the other thing that they do is they typically would have 2 to 3 university librarians working at the time. So I might get a query from a Ryerson student or a student somewhere, you know, physically very different to where I am. And does that work? Does quality suffer because of that? They put huge amounts of work into developing an intranet. So they hosted information there about all the different libraries and local knowledge about those libraries. What's their lending policy? What's their interlibrary loan policy? So I can go and check. If I have a student on from a university where I am not based, I would check that out. Also, a huge advantage in Ontario is that we have Scholars Portal. So that, and you might want to look at Scholars Portal. That's a very interesting project. Where they've basically we've engaged in consortial purchasing in Ontario to buy journals, to buy databases, and in fact got permission to host and archive the journals at the University of Toronto. So it's quite significant. And so we're all familiar with a very similar look and feel to databases and journals. So that helps, right? And the volume has been pretty substantial in growing. You can see some stats there. And at York and in the other places, we've been able to offer reference service in the evenings and weekends, which we simply couldn't do on our own. And the other thing that we have learned is that it's not just undergraduates coming into us. We've also learned that quality is, we think, generally maintained. So one of the lessons we did learn was it's not a good idea to combine college and university libraries. That did prove problematic. And my colleagues did a study. They did a random sample of York queries. And you can see from the yellow bar here, which is the colleges, that on local knowledge and on research queries, they weren't doing as well on accuracy and also on treating it as a teaching moment. There was sort of a different philosophy for reference. And we were having problems with college questions because they were more vocational and we just didn't have the training, like we didn't have the knowledge. So they split the queue and now you have university and colleges separated. Another thing we learned, really scary, our librarian at York did not do the best on the local knowledge questions. So, you know, that was an alarm bell, and so they did training with our librarian. So it's a training opportunity. They used the information to help us. And this is what people said in AFCON, just across the system, the voluntary exit surveys, and this is what they said. They were generally, hopeful so far, generally quite happy with the service. So it's a work in progress, but I think it's an interesting one. And if you want more information about it, I do have contacts, and I'd be glad to help out. And by the way, I don't know if my email is anywhere, but it's sbury, S-B-U-R-Y, at yorku.ca. Probably the best place to get me on and on. So, you have 10 minutes left. So I know I talked a lot, but thank you for your attention. And I'd be very interested in any questions, comments that you have.
First of all, thank you very much, Sophie. I have a question to start off with. You talked a lot about student-centered development of library and library services.
Yes.
And I think that's terrific and very much needed. Do you know that in Canadian academic libraries, they're also including faculty-centered design in library and library services, where in addition to talking with faculty, talking with students, they talk with faculty, staff members, academic staff members about what they want for themselves, what they want for their students, the trends that they see emerging in their educational and research practices, incorporating that into the design process.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I know at Guelph they have done that, and I know in my institution they're starting to include faculty more. What they did is they set up a big committee to plan the learning commons, and there were mainly, I think, those academic learning support services, also people from the Writing Centre and the Centre for Support Teaching. Those kinds of people were on that committee. Not a huge amount of faculty representation, but I believe now they have a new structure as they're getting more into the nitty-gritty, and they're going to have a committee which is basically designed to roll out the programming. And I know they're getting faculty involved in that, and I'm really happy to see that, because how can you begin? I mean, the faculty are the people who know the students, how they're learning in the classroom, and there's a lot of knowledge to be drawn on there. And in Sweden or in the States, have you come across successful models with that, or has anyone else here?
Well, I've been at various universities that take different approaches.
Yeah.
You know, some universities only one extreme, they don't think faculty exist or matter. You know.
Yeah.
They're there for the students, and that's it. And then on the other, on the other hand, in some cases, they're, the subject matter librarians will work very closely with the department of school to do design work. And actually, I've seen in some cases where branch libraries are located in the school space,
then
the school faculty feel very much an influence on the design of that space.
They're actually in the faculty of the library is right there.
In terms of supporting research, you mentioned areas like open journals for students and conferences and teaching processes and what types of other areas of knowledge like data set and digitization of maybe some of the specialized or unique collections being used to hold. Would you have a sense of how the research is being forged and wrapping it and part of the institutions beginning to collect and centralize access to those kinds of information
To be honest, it's not really my area of expertise, but I know we've done things at York, I know our digital initiative librarian has worked closely with the archives so that special collections are being digitized. And in fact, we've hired an e-archivist. And I think that's a growing trend in Canada. Because I know there's an argument that that's the future of academic library special collections, because it's what they will always have that's very unique. And putting it online is a very important direction. But I have to say, I'm not an expert on digitization projects. But, you know, I'd be happy to get your email and to liaise with our digital initiatives librarian and Tess if she would know more what's going on in that area. I'd be very happy to do that.
I have another question. And I think I'm going to another area where you're talking about information, which is the advocacy. That's a really interesting area. I work in the community library.
Right.
It's an area that people in particularly challenging. And a lot of our advocacy work on a relationship basis. So the any academics that you build up relationships with and who know you and then talk about learning outcomes and the benefits and learning information skills. Working on a higher level and getting them to program level, to school level, is a particular challenge.
Sure.
In terms of negative experience, we talk a little bit more detail. We talk about another experience.
I think we share those challenges. We have reintroduced an information literacy coordinator in 2004. And we're now at 2009. We've integrated information literacy in 7 programs, and we have lots of programs. That's a tiny percentage. And I think that the successes there have been due to the coordinator, but also have been very much down to subject librarians who are very good advocates and know their disciplines and who really care about information literacy. So I really think a lot has to happen at the grassroots level as well. I think where, though, at the sort of the top level, where things did make a difference was our information literacy coordinator brought language about information literacy into the university academic plan. So that did give her leverage when she went out and talked to deans about information literacy. So I think getting into those strategic documents at the university. It's not just lip service. I think we've seen how it makes a difference. And also, I don't know what it's like here, but we have librarians on Senate committees. Like, there's a representative on the Senate Committee on Teaching and Learning. Mm-hmm. And that's made a difference. And now they're trying to draw up a new green paper on teaching and learning. So we have a new associate vice president academic. And the librarians are being included. Mm-hmm. So I think you've got to work. From up and down. I don't have the answer yet. I wish I did. But I think, you know, slowly making progress.
I think in my friend community,
yeah,
we have access to the college teaching and learning
community. Oh, you do? Sure. Okay. Yeah, that's great.
But if you look at the graduate attributes that are listed for the university information, there's the community name, the attributes, the illustration of itself. And so it's continually a discussion again around advocacy of what component or what attribute has a literacy component to, and continually making the case for that. I think another interesting challenge where a lot of the information skills delivery in terms of subject matter given by the academics in the classrooms,
yeah,
and then the librarians for making the case why what they have to offer the professional level of knowledge is very interesting, but continuing that engagement of why is it difficult to you and can you do better than other things? So I think that's the staffing challenge that we're facing today.
Yes.
To use those two and requirements more.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there are a lot of changes there.
Yeah, I think something we want to look at more in information literacy, because yeah, there just only are so many librarians, and yes, you can do a certain amount of community learning, but I think it's recognising that a lot of information literacy also relates to faculty skills and what faculty can teach. And I did a survey of faculty at New York, and I'm going to do a discussion with them about this area when I go back, and I'd be happy to share what I learned. In fact, I put in an application to talk at LIAC. I don't know if it'll get accepted, but I know it's at UL this year. And basically, I think that thing that you're talking about is like, time is at such a premium. That's one thing I learned. Like, faculty have to get through a big curriculum, and putting in extra time for information literacy, they find challenging. And also, I think they teach information literacy themselves. That's one thing I learned in my survey, that I think it was 50-50 split, but I can't remember, actually, don't quote me on that. There's a lot of faculty saying, we teach this anyway. So I think if we can work with them to be partners and make consultants in some cases on certain skills, but I'm not convinced we always have to be in the classroom. And there are not enough of us anyway. Anybody else?
In relation to the reference at the end there, when we're looking at the sort of reference services, you know how you were talking about how there's an increase in how they're delivered, have you found then that the physical depth, the face-to-face reference service, has dropped, or has that managed to maintain itself in one of the connections between the two services? The virtual as a
thing. Yeah, that's a good question. I think one thing I have read that is a trend in American libraries, at least, is that the questions that are coming to the desk are more involved. Because I think, personally, I don't think virtual reference works very well for involved questions. I don't know what your experience is, but I think it gets to a point where you just need to talk to a person. I did try to get statistics for today on what is happening, and I asked my university librarian for the Oakville stats, and I just asked Carl, but they just gave me stats about e-reference service. So I have heard a rumor that reference desk stats are going down. But in my institution, that is not happening. So is it happening at UCD library? Do you find, do you know?
We don't think so.
I think it's a question around what is reference. One of the steps that we would convey to my brother's practice to come up in the subject was half more are directional or they're instructional, how to use the
data,
and how to find the way around the layout of the door and around the connection access to a long way. And a lot of the more specific are directed to the library.
Oh, yes, right. Yes.
So it depends on the referral service.
Yes,
well,
yeah. I know, for example, that Masters and other universities are, what they're doing now is they are not always putting librarians on the desk, it's library staff, which we call it, I don't know how you refer to it here, but that's what we would call a paraprofessional in Canada, and that they are often, reference librarians are working exclusively from their offices, so that's the only time they take reference groups, and that's not what we're doing, but I hear that there's a shift in that direction, because I think a lot of university librarians feel that's a better use of librarian time.
I suspect that the support for the research community grows within the UVA is there just not enough staff then to support all the work that we're doing.
Yes.
Often the staff is able to care and find support.
So the platform that I was interested in there and the idea of that staff by and another different university and colleagues coming together and collaborating about that. I just wondered about the types of women they were dealing with, because they just have to need a very wide ranging knowledge to deal with the institution and the university. So, really, isn't that something? How does the staff find that?
When I spoke to Adam, who was the person who headed it up with us, he said the main thing he focused on was that problems with when university librarians and college librarians answered the same group of questions. As I mentioned, that was then split. I think they probably need to do more detailed analysis, but I think they found that the development of the intranet site where they have, and it's really impressive, with loads, they have two full-time staff at the Ontario Library Association who work on ASPA. And they got that intranet site in place. They continually work on protocols, for the service, as well as building up a sort of a very rich site where people can find information. But I would admit, like, when I'm on a query and somebody, you know, from Thunder Bay and I'm trying to wait, you know, get, even though they've designed it quite nicely, trying to get through, well, where, what's there? And you're like, oh, quality. I mean, I find it, but it's not as good as it is before a student. Because, but I guess it's still better than your not doing any evening service or any weekend service, probably, you know? Well, I think it is. I think it definitely is. Because, yeah, because I... You know what? Adam mentioned to me that somebody did, Irene Tennyson did a detailed report for the OLA about the service about maybe 6 months ago, and he was going to try and track it down and send it to me. So if you want, after this session, I'm happy to take your email and just say, Adam, if you could get me that report, because that talks in quite a lot of detail about the experience. And to hear my knowledge is extensive enough. Yeah.
She very much that you get need to publish and to research. Because any of the work that you've been involved in terms of publishing our children is not television, it's often done in your own time.
Yeah.
This is a general question about where librarians publish their research and who they're trying to impact. And that can be the argument that we are producing the research. And would you have a view about publishing, librarians publishing in more subjective literature where your audience reads it, which is the actor?
Yeah, well, I think one thing is that I mentioned we embrace this open access publishing policy. So, in librarians, we're not mandated to publish in. an open access publication, but we are being encouraged to look at publications where they have at least, I know there's different tiers with open access, but at least where they're sort of embracing even a small element of open access. And the thing that Andrea stressed to me, and you may well know this, is that a lot of the mainstream publishers are doing that, the big names are doing that, at least at some level. So that's one thing, but then to get to your question about, like, is it in the LIS literature or is it in the moral literature, to be honest, what I mainly see, there are some exceptions, is in the LIS literature. But I have seen some of the librarians I know, especially I know quite a lot of people in information literacy circles because it's an interest of mine. They are starting to publish in education journals. And also go to, we have a conference called CEDAL, which is basically where a lot of educational developers go to that conference. So librarians are going more to that conference. I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. But I really think we're just only starting to do that, and we need to do more. But actually, one thing I should say is that our university librarian is not ever going to criticize one of us if we do not do LIS research. Like, we've had librarians, we had one librarian did his whole focus of his research was music and Jimi Hendrix for the whole year, he wrote a book, I think. And then our film librarian has written two books about film genre. And we have another librarian who is very into the humanities and I don't know exactly what she does, but she's not a librarianship. So I think that's really good that we are not told we have to do LIS focused research. But the librarians who do the other subjects are the exception rather than the norm. And I think that, and this is one of the things we were discussing, librarians have the ability to apply, to write about what they learned through operationalizing things in the workplace. Obviously, we have to bring in the literature and make it scholarly to some degree, but a lot of what we do is talking about, I guess, our profession and what we've learned through the practice of our profession. I don't know if you find that, but I find that's where I tend to get inspiration. That's a very grand question.
Any other questions or comments? If not, let's thank Sophie one more time. It's a great presentation.